Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. Joining me today from New York City is fellow critical surf study scholar, Dr. Kristen Lawler. Kristen's a professor of sociology at the College of Mount St. Vincent in New York City. Her first book, The American Surfer, Radical Culture and Capitalism, was published by Routledge in 2011. And her new book, co-edited with Michael Roberts and David Klein, entitled Rollin' Flow, The Political Ontology of Surfing and Skateboarding, it's being published by San Diego State University Press and should be available for purchase this fall. The American Surfer, however, can be found at surfinghistorian.com right now. So head on over and scoop up a copy. Oh, and while you're there, of course, check out our merch, as well as all the amazing nonprofits you can get involved with. For today's episode, we got a lot to cover. For starters, we'll be delving into the argument of her book, The American Surfer. We'll also be talking about her essay on the Nietzschean connections between early 20th century surfers and the hobos of the industrial workers of the world, an essay that'll be published in the forthcoming book, Rollin' Flow. And as if that's not enough to cover, I'll be picking her brain about her view on the current state of critical surf studies, a field we're both part of. I'm super stoked to have you on to share all this incredible insight with our listeners. Kristen and I were at a conference together at San Diego State University, so I'm really excited to get a chance to talk to her one-on-one about her research. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Kristen, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hi, Jason. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm thrilled to be here. I am making my way through the archives. It's such a great podcast, and I'm pleased that you are interested in my work and my book. So I thought I'd start by just talking a little bit about the argument in The American Surfer. You know, I'm a Marxist, and so most of my friends and comrades were pretty surprised that I was looking at surfing, because I'm also not a surfer, although I did make an attempt while I was like watching all these surf movies and writing about surfing. But my interest in surfing really began in kind of a funny way. I was teaching a class on social theory, and I was teaching Marx on alienation. And you know, the idea in the economic and philosophic manuscripts is really that under capitalism, what labor does is produce something kind of what Marx calls like an alien power, where we're constantly working or engaging in activity that is accruing to the benefit of that which comes to dominate us, as opposed to sort of aesthetic activity or activity that really cultivates the human. And so I had this feeling just in this class, it was ages ago, I was still a grad student, that the students weren't really understanding exactly what I was saying. And it happened to be that at the same time, a friend of mine had sent us this documentary called Step Into Liquid. And I was watching it and thinking, oh, that's the other of alienation. I'm going to show the students this documentary and look at this idea of being sort of engaged in activity that is sort of free and autonomous and not having to do with alienated labor under capitalism, that also was about kind of a connection to nature, a connection to the moment, a connection to other surfers. Yeah, it just kind of blew me away. And I was also interested in, and so I showed it to the students. They were like, oh, you know, and they just suddenly were speaking in the terms of the economic and philosophic manuscripts. So it functioned that way. The image of the surfer functioned, even in this small context, as a representation of a certain kind of anti-capitalist working class autonomous activity. And of course, I noticed that the surfers who wrote about this film were generally pretty critical of it. And the idea that it was, you know, made by Quicksilver and just, you know, kind of selling stuff. And so that's what I mean about like the fish I had to fry. When I saw that the missionaries that went to Hawaii and tried, did everything that they could to extinguish surfing altogether and make way for, you know, the plantations and the colonizers and all of that, in the same way that, you know, the Protestant sort of ethic in Europe, in the industrialization of Europe, those ministers had the same effect, right? They of instituting clock time. E.P. Thompson talks about this, instituting clock time over sort of a natural time rhythm of like you work until you don't need to work. You work until you like are fed and then you live because life is to be lived. Anyway, that was incredibly significant. Then I just started looking more and more and became more and more interested in how central the image of the surfer has been in not just American culture, but sort of global culture. But I looked at the American case as an image, as a symbol, as an archetype of the refusal of work. So, you know, there's lots of examples of this. John Rawls, the political philosopher in 1971, wrote A Theory of Justice, which is a very well-known piece of political philosophy, where he's talking about what a just society would look like. And the idea is that it's, you know, sort of the person on the bottom is still doing fine. That's not a very good, it's a little more complicated than that, but it's about like justice and fairness. And it makes perfect sense. It's like a perfectly closed system, except he has this thing where that he calls the Malibu surfer problem. And he says, which I love that term, he says, well, you know, there are people like the Malibu surfer who will insist on freedom and will refuse to do their part in this just system. So to me, that was really significant. There are so many examples of this. One of my favorite is Spicoli, of course. But, you know, well, if I'm here and you're here, doesn't that make it our time? You know, this question of time and who our time belongs to, and what does it mean to engage in activity that's about the freedom to constitute time on your own terms? I mean, I definitely got a lot of laughs back then taking Spicoli so seriously, but I feel vindicated by the emergence and or not emergence, but explosion of surf studies and of interest in sort of taking surfing seriously. Anyway, more recently, since I wrote the book, there's I had an essay on this in the Critical Surf Studies Reader, which is about the food stamp surfer. This was this big moment in Fox. It was on Fox News, but it wound up on the floor of the House of Representatives after the financial crisis of 2008. Of course, there was a massive expansion of food stamps because people were hungry. And the Republicans were very much against this. And one of the things that Fox News did, they found this guy who was like a Spicoli guy. And he was on food stamps, $200 a month. Like, as it, I mean, there's so much about this that's ridiculous. But, and instead of being sort of ascetic about it, and instead of just buying lentils or whatever you're supposed to do on $200 a month on food stamps, he just bought like lobster and sushi and partied with his friends. And he got interviewed by a number of Fox hosts, including Sean Hannity, who were like, how can you do this? How can you not work? He's like, well, I'm trying to build up my rock and roll band. I really like surfing. He was this unapologetic, you know, sort of defender of his ability to be free and of the ability of people to eat, you know, and eat with pleasure and not with asceticism. So I thought that that was super interesting. And it also was once again, this idea that the image of the surfer is the image really of the refusal of work. And when I say the refusal of work, it's the references to a certain variant of Marxism called it generally comes from Italy. It's called autonomist Marxism. And the idea is that capitalism is not just made up of capital that like exploits everybody, and then everybody else, the working class, which is just sort of a passive victim of it. It's autonomous in the sense that the idea is that capitalism is a system made not of the dominator and the dominated, but of two opposing subjectivities. And the subjectivity of capital is to impose labor on people, moments, all of the natural world, to make everything work for the purpose of something else, and profit, namely. Whatever it is, it has to be made into money. The opposing subjectivity, the working class subjectivity, this is in the work of Antonio Negri, is characterized in his work by a refusal of that, a refusal of work, and what they call self-valorization, which is autonomous, aesthetic, sort of freely engaged in projects. So for me, the image of the surfer, surfing itself, but also what I looked at was the image of the surfer, because of course, everything that surfers do is not entirely defensible. So I didn't necessarily, and I sort of felt like I wasn't a surfer. I didn't really know which kind of real surfing, but the image of the surfer I had been consuming since I was a child, this sort of California dream of freedom and pleasure and the beach and leisure and all of this stuff. So yeah, that's what I mean when I talk about the refusal of work. And it is consistent. It just keeps on sort of speaking in those terms of the refusal of work. And I feel like that's just incredibly important, remains incredibly important. I had such a fun time watching every surf movie, going back and looking at missionaries' accounts, horrified accounts of Hawaiians in the water, looking at tourist postcards coming from Hawaii, looking at every TV show, looking at Tom Wolfe and the Pump House Gang. I mean, it was just, I had a wonderful time doing this. It's very fun to watch. And I do think, you know, like I said, I think the book kind of holds up, but I actually think that some of the most interesting things are being done in surf studies now, and skateboard studies too, and the way that they sort of come together. But there's a lot of, in our book that's coming out, it's co-edited by me and Mike Roberts and David Klein, who are both at San Diego State and both on the Surf and Skate Collaborative helped to organize the conference, the Stoke Sessions, which we were both at. It was such a fantastic experience. That book, there's a lot of theoretical work coming out of the theories of Gilles Deleuze and others. There's some great filmmaking that continues to happen, and that's happening in skateboard studies. I really, when I wrote The American Surfer, my sense was that there wasn't a whole lot out there. And in some ways I was wrong. There was some, what was there was good. But what I see now happening in surf studies is extraordinary. I'm thrilled to be part of this community of thinkers and researchers.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Kristen, to be fair, I think your book came out in 2011.
Yes.
And that really was, you know, that was early in the field, you know, I would say. So I think you should give yourself a bit more credit. But, you know, at the same time, you really were on the front lines of what others and I talk about is that, you know, eye roll when you talk about doing research in surfing, in particular when you're dealing with, you know, political theories and you know, Marxism and all these things. And then all of a sudden you say, well, yeah, I'm going to also talk about surfing. I would imagine you got some serious eye rolls, but you know, I kind of came into the field in, I would say accidentally, in that my committee chair, co-chair as a sports historian essentially said, hey, Jason, you can write about surfing in Nicaragua. Of course it has to be grounded, you know, academically sound. You can't just write about, you know, you and your friends surfing. So I would say your work, some of the other individuals you've mentioned, Aaron James, who I had on, a lot of you guys who put out early works were really, really helped me at least see that this was a legitimate field. And so, you know, I'm super stoked that you guys were in a sense on those front lines. And even as a non-surfer, seeing how we can critically view the world through this lens. And, you know, as I've said before, I'm fascinated with your work. I reference you in my dissertation, and I love the Spicoli reference, right? Because it really does embody this, you know, this sort of hippie stoner surfer, and not all surfers are like that, obviously, you know, I'm not going to generalize like that, but it really does, you know, in terms of what you were trying to accomplish, does embody that sort of counterculture figure pushing back against this structure. And, you know, again, I have a question for you and along those lines. And I know, you know, Aaron James and I talked about essentially philosophy and Sartre and freedom and surfing and how all that sort of woven together. And but I'd really like to understand how you have been able to draw this connection between Marx and alienation, and really, really kind of simply put, how do you see surfing serve as this utopian or freedom lifestyle? And there's kind of two parts to this. The other part is, you know, how do you see, because again, we were just talking about surfing somewhat mutually exclusive to capitalism, and we both know good and well it's not. So kind of the second part to that is, how do you see the capitalist forces at work in surfing and in surf culture?
Okay, they're great questions, and thank you for your comments about my work. I appreciate it a lot. On both of those questions, I think I would say to begin with that the countercultural idea is something that one of the reasons that the working class, this is my analysis, one of the reasons that the working class took such a severe beating in the late 20th and into the early 21st century, although I think that there's different things going on now, but especially just moments kind of culminating in the 1981 firing of all the air traffic controllers, the kind of union busting, outsourcing, real intense attack coming from capital on the American working class during that period, the breaking of what was called the Treaty of Detroit, which is just a broad word for literally a treaty between auto workers and makers in 1950, but also really just broadly speaking more to this kind of post-war labor peace between capital and labor, basically after World War II, because the rest of the industrial world was reduced to rubble. American corporations were able to become these transnational corporations. And in my analysis, they made a deal, you know, it was called the Wages for Productivity deal. And the idea was that they would go around and super exploit everybody else and just pay off the American working class with kind of high wages and cars and all of the public investment. The working class actually kind of broke that deal because they took the money and ran and engaged in the 1960s in all kinds of countercultural activities, really pushing back against that 1950s labor peace, productivity, kind of humming capitalism. They said, no, actually, this is fine. High wages are fine, but we also want no war and sexual freedom and, you know, for women, and we want Black liberation and we want queer liberation and all of these things that I think I see the history of capitalism as the history of class struggle. That's ultimately what it means to be a Marxist. And so capital hit back pretty hard. And I think that one of the reasons that capital, there are a lot, of course, this is not the only one, but one of the reasons that capital was able to hit back so intensely was precisely the eye rolling about the counterculture that you're talking about. Because the left, broadly speaking, I don't even know if those terms mean anything anymore, but became ashamed of our own most libidinally liberationist, radical parts of us, whether it was liberal feminism, marginalizing radical, the sexual freedom feminism, whether it was things happening in the civil rights movement and in the unions that marginalized the most militant and really most hopeful cultural politics of the Black liberation movement, including inside the United Auto Workers. Whether it's, I just think whether it's the left more broadly deciding that the counterculture was something they just wanted to roll their eyes out. It's not just Spicoli. It is politicos in general that don't take cultural politics seriously as essential to the class struggle. And I do, and I think Max Weber does too. And I think Karl Marx does too. But the idea, and E.P. Thompson, all of these people that talk about the kind of cultural values around work, the glorification of work as some kind of ethical good, as being essential to the very building of capitalism. So if you want to talk about opposing capitalism, the anti-work, the countercultural idea, which really is about a refusal of work, a refusal to look at the activity of everyday life as something that should be for the purpose of something else, rather than engaged in for its own sake. Life is short. We should be here and take care of each other and have fun and have pleasure and go surfing and play music and do all the things that make us human beings. All the things, by the way, that this fucking AI can't do. So all the things that make us different from machines. And that's sort of what I mean about the early 21st century, the stuff that's beating us now, which is also a different kind of cultural politics. In any case, I think on the question of surfing and capitalism, the sort of maybe other part of your question, we are never not inside capitalism. There's no outside point from which we can critique capitalism. We're always inside it. We are always partial to one side or another. And we are either doing things that make us more powerful as a class, as a working class, or we're doing things that make us less powerful. And I don't mean individually, I mean, obviously, sort of the class as a whole. To me, when workers, and this is why this post-pandemic moment is so fascinating to me, and the tight labor market and all of the ways that capital is flipping out right now, they keep raising interest rates and still people are like, I don't know, maybe I'll just go surfing instead. Maybe I'll do something else. I think maybe we could talk about that. I think there's such an interesting kind of post-pandemic existential moment that the working class as a whole has been having. But either way, there is one of the other groups that I study is the hobos of the industrial workers of the world in the early 20th century, sort of very militant, very countercultural, really the root of much of American counterculture, whether you think about it as the Beats and On the Road and like the hippies, stuff like that. It's really, it's another with surf culture, I think, independent root of American counterculture. Well, the Wobblies had, that's, you know, the industrial workers of the world, they get called the Wobblies. They were called that then. They were also called I Won't Works and I Want Whiskey, because they were mostly Irish too. So they drank a lot of whiskey. But they engaged in practices of sabotage at the point of production and in terms of cultural politics. And so this is, again, it's this kind of refusal of work and self-valorization together. And the refusal of work is really a slowdown at the point of production. When we work like crazy for capital, we drive our own wages down as a class. When you flood the market with any commodity, you're gonna drive the price down. When you restrict the supply of that commodity to the market, the price goes up. That's why capital's flipping out right now at the tight labor market. So the Wobblies used to, one of my favorite posters about sabotage is slow down. The job you save may be your own. And I think that surfing and thinking about surfing and capitalism, the fact that the image of the surfer all the way through has been about engaging in free activity. It's a form of a slowdown. The more people surf, the less labor is supplied to the market. I think Aaron James makes a point similar to that too, which I like very much.
Yeah, I think he says something along the lines that, I mean, I think he talks a little bit about, he goes into something about climate change as well, but I think one of the things either in the book jacket or something is, you know, work less and surf more type mm-hmm. thing. So yeah, exactly.
Fantastic. Yeah. His stuff is great. As he knows, my only quibble with his work is that he doesn't talk enough about how Sartre became a Marxist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We didn't get into that during our interview, but yeah, that's, you know, he was very much somebody who was friendly, I guess you'd say, with the Fidel Castros, the Che Guevaras, those the sort of revolutionaries of the late 50s, if you will.
Yeah, Frantz Fanon, all that. Yeah, he was Sartre's a great, and Aaron's book is great. I love that book.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but as you were talking about the surfer, and I don't want to say that you romanticize the surfer because I completely understand exactly where you're going with that, but it does seem, you know, you talked about some of the union busting and things of that nature, and that really. I think, at least as more of a modern historian, I see that really coming more full force, starting more or less in the Reagan years with the introduction of the new right. Yeah. And really more in the modern era. I know the Wobblies are much older than that, obviously. But and so the reason I bring that up is because and this is where the eye rolling comes from. And, you know, obviously I'd like to get your thoughts on this, but during the Reagan years, you had this sort of image making of the welfare queen. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And it seems to me that surfers, even though that image is, I think, changing to a certain extent, but I think they also get, you know, somewhat maybe caricatured. I think that might, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but as this bum that is mooching and, you know, sort of, you know, mooching off the system as opposed to contributing to that system. And I think that really is at the heart of what you're trying to convey in your book and in your work in general, that it is pushing back against this structure that needs labor. And by not joining in on that labor force or that labor culture, let's call it, they are by default being somewhat counterculture, but also it makes sense that those that are advocates of labor would ultimately speak about surfing maybe pejoratively or in frame them in a negative light in much of the way Reagan attempted to highlight this woman, which I don't even think she was a real woman. It was just a kind of a made up story, but still sort of caricature this woman. In the same way, you know, Spicoli gets used as the example of all or quintessential surfers. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but I just wanted to sort of put that out there to hear what what you're thinking about it.
It's so important. And this food stamp surfer on Fox News is exactly the Cadillac driving welfare queen. It's the same image. And it's not an accident that countercultural types all the way through and African Americans have been caricatured in this way. What I think is most interesting about, and of course I feel like instead of saying no, we work so hard, all we want to do is work, which is precisely what happened. It was with the food stamp surfer and with the welfare queen stuff. Those on the progressive side said no, and rightly so. Right. In some ways, on the floor of the House, literally during the debate over Obama's expansion of food stamps, people said they put restrictions on what you could buy with food stamps. And literally, you can't buy filet mignon. You can't buy, in most states, you can't buy shrimp or lobster or whatever because of this food stamp surfer guy. And of course, the sort of progressive said, listen, this guy is not the image of most people on food stamps work very hard. They just don't make high enough wages. That's why they need income support. Of course, that's absolutely true. And that was true when it came to the sort of the image of the ghetto welfare queen or whatever. The Wobblies, one of my favorite Wobbly songs is Hallelujah, I'm a Bump, you know? So I feel like there is something about the kind of unapologetic refusal that is important. The other thing I think is incredibly important about these images, they're slacker images. They're images of, like you said, moocher, slacker, whatever, won't work, takers, not makers, whatever it was that that Mormon guy said. I forget his name. Anyway, one of the things I think is so interesting about this, and the food stamp surfer moment One of the things that happened is that Sean Hannity was getting more and more angry with this guy, Jason Greenslate, when he had him on the show. And he was saying at a certain point, it almost slipped out of his mouth at the very end. He said, "You think I want to work? I've done nothing but work. You think I want to be working?" And it was, that's always what happens. Because the truth is, if these cultural figures, whether it's Reagan and the welfare queen or Hannity and the food stamp surfer or any number of millions of iterations of this dynamic, if they loved work so much, if they thought work was so great, they would not resent people who didn't work. They would say, "Oh, well, you're missing out on what life is all about," right? But it's precisely because they hate it. It's precisely because nobody wants to sell their life to someone else. No one wants to engage in activity all the time. That's not what they would naturally want to be doing. That's where the resentment comes from. And I see that. I wrote a thing on the Greek and the European debt crisis and the relationship between, because it was a very similar thing, the Germans versus the Greeks and the Portuguese and what they called the pigs. It was so disgusting. But the whole idea, especially with the Greek crisis, was that the Greeks are just too lazy and won't work. And it was a similar kind of a beachy thing. And really, you can see behind the moralistic judgments is really just a certain kind of what Nietzsche called ressentiment. Underneath that hostility to the figure of the slacker is a certain kind of resentment. And that resentment actually comes from a certain kind of an anti-work ethos, even on the part of those who are enforcing the work ethic. There is still this anti-work moment. And that's why I think these kind of images are so intractable in a way, why they occupy such an immense place in the American political imagination, not because I think everybody is a little more countercultural than we might imagine. And I think that that kind of countercultural sensibility can be taken up by the right in ways that are incredibly dangerous. And that's why I think for a liberationist, for a utopian kind of politics, it's important that we embrace this, because if the progressive side of things, if the so-called good guys are only talking about work and rationality and sort of system maintenance, then all of that cultural material is still available. And it becomes available to be mobilized by forces like Fox News for other kinds of purposes. And I think that's profoundly dangerous. So yeah, I think the eye rolling is BS. I think we got to take these countercultural politics seriously. On your question about, and I got a question about this at the conference, one of the talks I gave at the conference, really, it's so important. What does it mean that surfers are so often the vanguard of the worst forms of kind of neo-imperialism and stuff like that, and imperialism, even the old-fashioned kind? And I think that's a really, really important question. I just think if you look at urban politics or gentrification, right? Artists are always on the front lines of gentrification because you need cheap space to make art and stuff. Does that exhaust the significance of artistic activity for human beings? I don't think so. I think we live in a capitalist society, so very often the coolest things that we do, the best things that we do, the most human things that we do, become co-opted for terrible purposes. That's part of what capitalism does. It eats resistance for breakfast in many ways, but it doesn't. There's always an overflow. There's always a surplus. And one of the things that's interested me so much about the image of the surfer is how inspirational it has been. And I think these images that remind people of what it means to engage in activity that is really not the same as alienated labor, it's just absolutely brilliant. And I think that it speaks to the meaning of this image, the significance of this image, which again, and the significance of the practice of surfing. I just don't think it's exhausted by all of the ways that capital will use the life force of human beings for its own machine of waste, exploitation, and destruction. I think those things still matter. I mean, that's what human labor is, essentially, right? And capital uses it to feed its machine. But it doesn't mean that our human self-activity then is meaningless. It's actually still the essence of all of it. And we've got to get it back.
Well, it's, you know, I'm kind of laughing because I'm thinking to myself, you know, all of my surf friends, they love what you're saying, because it really does sort of romanticize them in a way as on the vanguard of this, you know, march towards freedom and, like I said, as you were talking, I'm thinking of, you know, that long-standing existential question, like, what is the meaning of life? And, you know, I think the comparisons you're drawing are certainly valid, in that the sort of countercultural surfer is pushing back against this capitalist economic force. And because they're opting for, say, less capital gain and more, more life experience, let's say, more time at the beach, more time surfing, more time, quote unquote, bumming around. But they are, and again, I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you were saying, but in a sense, they are, you know, sort of milking life more so than the Sean Hannitys and others that were interviewing them, and almost had, as you said, like a bit of resentment behind their tone, because they're while they are making way more money than, say, these surfers, the surfer is perhaps living life more. And I think that's kind of at the heart of everything it seems to be at the heart of all of your work. And I do want to segue briefly before we, you know, bring the episode to a close, because you have this new book coming out that you're part of. You've published an essay in it, Roll and Flow. And in it, you claim to draw a Nietzschean connection between early 20th century surfers and the hobos of the industrial workers of the world. And again, I know you've already mentioned the Wobblies, but can you just, for myself, because I find that connection quite fascinating, and for the listeners, obviously, can you explain a bit about what that means and how you even draw a comparison like that?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, sure. This is This is an essay that is co-written by me and Mike Roberts. We do a lot of our work together. We've written two essays and an introduction in this book. And one of them is this kind of hallelujah, I'm a beach bum moment. And, you know, the way that I came to it actually was realizing there were a couple of things. Mike had seen a documentary by this surfer filmmaker named Cyrus Sutton called Stoked and Broke. And it was sort of about like a staycation on the Southern California coast. And one of the things, it absolutely blew us away, that at one point he's like busking for money, he and his friend, and in San Diego, and he sings this song called The San Diego Beaches, which is just a slight reworking of the Big Rock Candy Mountain, which is probably the most famous of all of the wobbly songs. But that's in terms of the working class counterculture that the IWW generated, songs were a huge part of it, right? There were stickers and magazines and cartoons and music and all kinds of stuff. But these songs, and especially these songs that took other songs, it was a form of cultural sabotage, because they would mess around with kind of the more dominant, especially Salvation Army songs and stuff like that. But either way, in the Big Rock Candy Mountain, in both of these moments of it, they shot the jerk that invented work. That's one of the things that happened. So it's this great sort of anti-work anthem. And I wish that these songs were still being sung by the American labor movement. We might be winning, because we would have more power at the point of production if we were engaged in a broad slowdown the way that the Wobblies advocated. However, it's not really happening in the American labor movement. Where these songs still exist is in surf culture. So as someone who's interested in both of these moments, this blew me away. And I started looking and noticing also that Jack London, the socialist, wrote about both the hobos and surfing. And then, you know, Dave Matusek, who wrote the book about San Onofre surfers, which is the most incredible sort of reference, great story. He wrote about the way that these surfers in San Onofre in the early part of the 20th century, who are sort of like hobos, they're the surfer hobos in a way. They were itinerant workers. They did work only when they needed to, stuff like that. That they sang these songs. There are also other kinds of connections that are really, really, it's been kind of an incredible scholarly moment for me and Mike to kind of unearth some of these connections. Harry McClintock, also known as Haywire Mac, who wrote Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, he claimed that he and Joe Hill, who's the great sort of Don't Mourn organizer, you know, like Don't Mourn Organize, this great figure of wobbly culture, the great songwriter, he wrote The Rebel Girl and all these great, you know, songs, incredibly important character. Haywire Mac says that they worked on boats and spent a couple of months just beachcombing in Hawaii, which is, it's just a story. I don't know if it's true. There are biographers of Joe Hill who say there's no way that happened, but as a myth, I love it. As a story, I love it. So one of the things, Jack London, just like Deleuze, was a Nietzschean. And so there are these commonalities, besides these kind of like concrete commonalities between the most radical American labor movement countercultural formation, the Wobblies, and surf culture. I think this is incredibly important. And some of the connections are very Nietzschean. Nietzsche is all about, you know, he has so many great quotes, but like, say yes to life, this kind of purely affirmative vitalist way of thinking about life and the world, the idea of the will to power, which is really just understanding that the world is made up of different kind of forces and intensities coming at each other. There are so many ways in which these guys are, but both groups are very Nietzschean. He's got I'll just say one, but there are a lot. So stay tuned for the book, because then you can read about all of them. But Nietzsche's got this concept of the eternal return, the eternal recurrence of the same, which is a widely, like the will to power, a widely misunderstood concept. The eternal return means, really, would you, whatever you're doing right now, it's kind of an ethic. Would you agree to do it again and again and again forever? Because if so, you're doing the right thing. And if not, you probably should make a change or try to make a change, try to do something different. In terms of the surfer, the eternal return is, of course, incredibly clear. You just can't, day after day, you go to the beach, you go back in the wave, you ride another wave, and then you ride another wave, right? It is a pure affirmation of a vital activity. And for the hobos, there's this sort of eternal recurrence as well, where capitalism and capital sort of wants us to see our lives as progress. You work and then you save and you advance and you do these things, and that's all supposed, you get a bigger car, you get a better car, you get a bigger house, you make more money, blah, blah, blah. The hobos were much closer to what the anthropologist Marshall Solins called the original affluent society. Solins has this great moment, this great essay, where he talks about, although we look back on hunting and gathering societies as being much more materially poor than we are, they were actually truly affluent because they had everything they needed. They didn't hoard stuff because they always knew that they could go hunting again, or they always knew there would be more, so that they could just relax and enjoy what they had. The hobos were like that too. And one of the most interesting things about looking at these guys is all of the journalists and sociologists and sort of social workers who would keep on saying, don't you want to work hard and then save your money? And they were like, nope. They would just, now it wasn't so easy for them to do it either. There are material conditions besides just the cultural ethos that make people do things like this. But still, the idea was you work until you have enough money, and then you blow that money, and then you do it again. Right? Shamelessly, no progress at all. You know, just you work to live, not live to work.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to the book personally. And, I really, again, I know I've already said this on multiple occasions, I'm grateful for your work and all the other people that are contributing to this interdisciplinary field we call critical surf studies. And so, I do want to give you the last word, and I'd just like for you to give me your thoughts, really, as even a non-surfer, about the future of, what we call critical surf studies.
Well, to me, one of the things that's most interesting about the Stoke Sessions conference and the book Roll and Flow that's coming out, and there's another book coming out that the Surf and Skate Collaborative is involved in. The name is escaping me right now, and I feel bad about that, but it's going to be really good. It's a different aspect of sort of critical surf studies, you know, some of the thinking about diversity and indigeneity and all kind, correcting all kinds of records, within surfing and telling new stories, and great, great scholarship. So both of these books, I think, are going to be really great. And I hope everyone checks them out. But as far as our book and the Stoke Sessions conference, to me, what's most interesting is the coming together of surf studies and skate studies. And one of the things that we did at the conference, my favorite thing, is there are these wonderful Brazilian from Sao Paulo, social theorists, skateboarder, filmmakers who have done incredible work. We write about them in the book. They came to the conference. We had a plenary session where we kind of introduced the, you know, showed some clips of the films. The films are highly, highly theoretical. And just the one thing I'll say about the, and they're incredible skate footage, and it's all street skating. You know, it's about the way in which skateboarders materially reshape the city. The city is, the architecture of the city exists in a certain way to tell you, like, here's where you work, here's where you consume, here's where you go to sleep so you can go do it back all the next day, move it along, what's your business here? And skateboarders materially reshape the city in according to a logic of play and not work, art and not alienation, flow and not segregation. And that is a form of cultural sabotage, right? It's a form of, these guys are like the Situationists in Paris in the 50s and 60s, in that they have these practices of the dérive and détournement, which is, détournement is like a form of sabotage, sort of hijacking, culture jamming of the products of capitalist culture. And the dérive is a way of being in the city, a way of walking around the city, but it's applicable to skateboarding because they do this. They use this idea. They quote Guy Debord. They're doing it. They're totally Situationists. One of the groups is called the Flanantes. So it, you know, sort of harkens back to the flaneur of Baudelaire and that Walter Benjamin wrote about. But they're really talking about this, especially this notion of the dérive, which is about not a random walk through the city, but a conscious refusal of the habitual influences, the things that the city tries to make you do. You sort of refuse that and you do something different. And those kinds of you produce situations that again produce new assemblages, new subjectivities. I think it's really extraordinary. So I'm thrilled about the coming together of surf and skate studies.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Kristen about surfing and capitalism, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by environmental science and resource management professor, Dr. Dan Reinemann. Dan and I'll chat about the two broadly overlapping domains of his work, equitable coastal access and surfing resource management. We even get into how waves break and how climate change, sea level rise, and erosion can have an impact on many of those breaks. We'll also chat a bit about how he came to study surfing for his job. If all that gets you amped up, then this will no doubt be an episode you won't want to miss. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.